Hello there, my name is Chris Cook and welcome to TW Talks, the interviews podcast from 3 Weeks Edinburgh. We are at Edinburgh Festival 2024, sitting in the lounge at Assembly George Square, right next to the club bar and all the studio venues. The festival is very much happening around us as we speak, and I am chatting to comedians who are performing at this year's Fringe. Today, Will Robbins, who is this year performing the show with the best Will in the world. We are going to talk past, present and future, the story so far, this year's show and what is happening next. Okay, I'm back now with my next guest, joined by Will Robbins. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Christopher Cook.
Okay, so we're going to do past, we're going to do present, we're going to do future. I guess we should start with past. So before we get to this year's Edinburgh show, why don't we talk through your sort of route through comedy and performance?
It started, I always wanted to do stand-up. I think I probably started it quite late compared to other people, maybe 26. I started gigging regularly. I think my partner at the time gave me that confidence. She was like, you got to do it. You're very funny. You should just get up and do it. So I started, she pushed me. I did it. And then I loved it. And then I was gigging every night. And she was like, you got to stop doing this, actually. This is too much. You don't love me anymore. So we're not together anymore. But that was
the comedy still going.
Yeah. The comedy relationship is still going somewhere. So yeah, that's how it started.
And just to clarify, when you said I started doing it, what does that mean?
That means you go to a shitty little pub and you have some words on a page which don't make any sense. You might think they make sense in your head. You go to the front of the room in front of loads of other people, mainly 10, 15 other comics, and you're shaking and you read it out. You only look at the paper. You don't look at the audience. And then you run home and sob. And then you just keep doing that for 8 years.
So these were open mic nights that you were?
Yeah. I started on open mic, which is where everyone kind of starts, I think, unless you can bypass it if you're one of the lucky ones. But yeah, no, I liked it because you're just sort of figuring it out. You can mess around. What if I do this? What if I do this? Yeah, you're playing around. You have to get over it. You have to bomb 100 times. And get over that. And yeah, open mics, mainly around London. But yeah.
And once you'd started doing that, and as you suggested, it became taking over your life.
Yeah.
So I guess the thing is, at what point do you start to think, okay, this is now working. I've done my, you know, I know what works. I know what doesn't work. At what point did you actually think, actually, do you know what? This is going to be my main thing in my life.
I think getting an agent helped. It was like, that was like, right, a bit of validation. It took me 3 or 4 years to get an agent. And that was quite exciting. That was like a little mini step. I think there's lots of mini steps or things that keep people in it, keep people going on. And you know, every creative will have doubts all the time, being like, why am I doing this? Do I really want this? I think that's very normal. And just before maybe a big gig or important gig, you can be like, oh God, what am I doing? Kept going. Yeah, the agent helped.
I mean, I often think when people look from the outside into the comedy industry, I guess, I don't know, there's an assumption that, I mean, obviously there is a machine within the industry.
Yeah.
But actually, most comedians are, you're your own machine. You, in essence, you are a performer, but you're also sort of building your own thing around your performance. And you're looking for those people in the industry to come on support, agent obviously being a big one. But actually, there's a lot of work for you to do off stage.
It's all about the performer and the person. And what I mean by that is they have to be pushing their own rudder, or that's not even a real they have to be pushing themselves. It's like people I've had a lot of new comments be like, god, I just want an agent. I always just say no, you need to just like hammer the gigs on your own, write with yourself and people, try and build your social media, just do it all, and then you know they will flock to you.
Because I also say, because what the industry wants to do is to escalate something you've started.
Exactly, you know, that we start the ball rolling, and they're like, oh, we can see that now. We can see what they're trying to do. That's something's happening there. There's a bit of he's making waves in a live gig, or he's getting good responses online, and the agent will be like, let me come and boost you up a tiny bit more. But no, it's all up to the artist. Even if you get signed, that's not a time to rest on your laurels. You need to, yeah. So social media, cane the gigs, write, rewrite, die, that kind of thing.
And back in the early days of doing the all those open mic nights, I mean, was it clear from you from the start of the kind of comedy you wanted to make? Or was it just, I like making people laugh, I'm going to do comedy, and then you learned as you were performing?
Yeah, I felt like it was a journey. I didn't quite know where I was going. I didn't quite know what my voice was. Or, you know, was I shouty and aggressive? Was I deadpan? You know, all these things you just have to... I don't think you can plan it. You're just like, right, go out there, try new things, mess around, have fun, shout at someone in the audience, see if they like that. Be deadpan, be polite. You know, just what you just have to just try everything, work out what your character is, see what feels most natural and what is getting the biggest laughs. And that is like how you find out, trial and error, I think they call it.
Let's talk through your Edinburgh Fringe journey now.
Yeah.
When did you first come to this festival?
Yeah, I came maybe 5 years ago. I think I did a three-way split. So
you and two other comedians each doing
exactly. We probably booked in for a week-long run, and it was at 12:30, meaning just after midnight. It was up a dark alleyway just off Cowgate. We thought, because it was off Cowgate, that was prime location.
It was central. If only people could find it.
That's what we thought. But when we actually came to Edinburgh for the first time, we were flying on Cowgate, and the venue was up about 100 steps, which was not lit by street lamps, and it's where... people would congregate and take heroin and sit with their, you know, their drinks and their dogs and whatever. So we would like fly people all drunk. It's 12:30. We're like, yeah, come to a gig. It's just this really dodgy alleyway. You're very close to it. It's just if you look over to the left. Yes, up there where there's no light and there's people hanging out.
Well, go up enough of those stairs and there's comedy at the top.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. It was not easy. I remember one guy, because everyone's drunk, one guy was like, he took the fly. He's like, is it good? I can't do the Scottish accent. I'm going to try. He goes, if it's shite, I'll stab you. And I was like, well, don't come there. I don't think I can handle that pressure. I'm an anxious person anyway. He said he wanted to come, and he said, if it's bad, I'll stab you. And I can't remember. I think he did come and he did like it in the end. But yeah, we did like two shows out of a week long run because we didn't have any people on seats. So that was my first experience of Edinburgh.
So I guess having described your first Edinburgh, I think the obvious question, not to people who know this festival well, but the obvious question for any other people is, so why was there a year two at the Edinburgh Festival? That does not sound like it was a fun experience.
No. We were like, right. No, we learned so much. We were like, that's a crap venue. That's a bad time. Maybe our poster wasn't good enough. Maybe we'll hire a couple of... We just learned everything in that first year. It was a disaster, but a massive learning curve. So next year we did it, chose a slightly better venue, better time. Still had trouble getting bums on seats. And then didn't do it for a few years. And then I got something called the Comedy Reserve, which is something the Pleasance Theatre do. They just pay for four acts every year to come up to the Fringe. They see a bit of potential and be like, right, let's help him do Edinburgh for the month, because I'd never done it for the month. So that was last year, and great experience. Put us up, gave us a room, we didn't have to fly. It was a lovely time, lovely venue. That was everyone was coming up to me being like, enjoy this. Enjoy this. This will be your best year ever.
As good as it gets.
Yeah, you're a lucky bastard. But I didn't really get what they meant. But now I do, maybe this year.
And I guess that almost comes back to what I was saying earlier, isn't it? As a comedian, as you're sort of growing the audience and you're progressing that career, it is as much you've got to craft the art on stage and work out what works in terms of the comedy, but then you are also, in essence, you are a bit of an entrepreneur, and as you say, you did those two Edinburghs, which was just learning how you do how you don't to play the Edinburgh Fringe. And each year you come back, a, what you're doing on stage is evolving, but also how you deal with it,
do the admin side, and like pick a venue and pick a time, and it's a lot. I don't think comedians are naturally admin.
You know, the best everything ends up being a spreadsheet for something.
No, I think there's a lot of comedians who end up getting quite far because they're good at admin. I don't know if that makes sense. So they're like, I like speak to comedians, I'm like, how did you get onto that? And then they're like, well, I've just emailed this promoter and I never don't hear about it, I go again. I've just emailed them, I'm very organized, and they're like, I record every gig and I put it out. I think if you are organized, that obviously needs to be good and different and whatever, but it helps to be organized and be sort of, you know, militant with your admin and your social media and all that.
I guess in terms of comedians wanting to know how somebody else got something, yep. I think I could be asking you, so how, the Pleasance Reserve thing that you mentioned last year, how did you get that? So how did you get that opportunity?
I applied. Every year they open up applications. You have to answer three or four questions. Tell us about your comedy. Tell us where you see yourself. Tell us why you, blah, blah, blah. I think I applied for it the year before, didn't get it. And then I got it last year, probably wrote the questions a bit better. And then you have to go for an audition. And so you go into there's like 10 of us. You do a 7-minute gig and there's a judging panel in there. And they choose who they think could be good for it. Yeah. I was very lucky. I couldn't imagine myself doing the whole month because of like money reasons. Might have mentioned that in my application form. So that, you know, it's a good thing they do. It's expensive to do the whole run.
And being able to do that full month.
Yeah.
Because as you say, that is a challenge for any performer at this festival. Yeah. We all know, I mean, how expensive it is, what the risk is. And understandably, an increasing number of performers might do the first 10 days second 10 days, things like that. Totally understand that. Flip side of all of that is, I think there is something special about being here for the full 25 days. And I guess last year was the first year you'd experienced it. You're part of that full experience.
It is special. And I wanted to do, I mean, after the end of last year, I was like, no, I'm not doing it next year. I can't. But that's just what everyone says, I think, on the final week. And then I just chilled out for a couple of months. And then I was like, hang on a minute, I'd like to do that next year. And I've been gigging for a while before the reserve. So I thought I'd just do it because I was putting it off. I didn't want to do the hour, really. I was putting it off. And my agent was like, just put all your old material together and then say something lovely at the end. that's kind of it. And I'm just going to pop my debut cherry and then, come back with a show winner in a couple of years.
Well, that's the show we're here to talk about.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So let's talk about this year's show.
Yeah, yeah, with the best will in the world. That's it. What I've done is just lie to people because obviously I'm not the best will in the world. I like to check if there's any wills in the room and then figure out what they do for work and then just see who...
You can beat them.
Just see if I can beat them. Normally they beat me. And, you know, there was a doctor called Willin last night and hats off to him. He was the best will in the room. And, you know, the audience felt like they'd been conned out of a lot of money. What's the show is about doing things for money that you don't want to do. And I politely decline various like job offers and or end up doing them if the money's right. Various jobs like I was Disney were looking for short actors for a fantasy movie to be a goblin, to be precise. And I'm not really on board. I don't really like that. I did do it that one time just for the experience. I thought it would be fun to do once. But I don't really like. I think short people should be playing. Humans and in everyday roles, going to their job and going home to their partner, whatever, not some like troll in a cave eating raw meat out of a bin or something. I talk about that. That's and then there's a couple other random job offers that I've had which are interesting.
And do you think, obviously, being at this festival where all these performers from all over the world, and I think, you know, many performers, comedians, but other performers as well. Certainly early on in their career, but actually for a lot of people, even when they're quite far in their career, as a performer, there is that constant balancing act of the work you do because it's what you love and it brings you fulfillment, etc. But then realistically, there are the projects which pay the rent. And it is that balancing act of between, you know, providing I'm being creative, I need to balance the stuff that's there for love and the stuff that's there. Because, you know, you've got to have a viable business to what you're doing.
That's a tricky one. That's a fine line. Because obviously we would love to do all the roles or jobs that resonate with us and that feel right for me in particular or whatever. But sometimes, you do get a job offer and you're like, I don't know about that. But the money's good. So you just weigh it up. In an ideal world, you just wouldn't do it. But it's not an ideal world. So you might be like, fuck it, I'll do it for the money. Which doesn't make you feel good long term. But a bit of money does make you help pay the rent. So you just got to juggle it,
And so you talked about that, taking that big leap that all comedians take from to the first 1 hour show. From doing, you know, your 10, your 20, your 30 minute set. So I guess now that you're doing the 1 hour show, I mean, what's the process you go through? Do you start with a blank sheet of paper? Do you have material that you're drawing from that you've been doing elsewhere?
I think as it was my debut, I have looked back at old notebooks and what I'm doing and picked out sort of favorite bits or bits that have been working, kind of just put them together and been like, it's semi-autobiographical. It's, you know, where was I born, where did I grow up, countryside, what did I do for work? I did loads, and I talk a lot about jobs, various, you know, I've been a chauffeur, worked in a call center selling hearing aids. I've just done a whole heap of like quite bizarre jobs. And then what else? And then I talk about, yeah, my dad a lot, and making my dad proud. Everyone in my family is average height, and my dad is a tall, strong man. And I talk about wanting to like impress. I think it's the same for anyone and their father. But yeah, that's a running. And I noticed I was talking about my dad a lot in my early stand up years. So I was like, right, he could be in it. He's a thread. That's people can relate to that. And then people doing jobs for money, people can relate to that. And yeah, nice little heartfelt bit at the end. I talk about, yeah, the word disability. My dad was always like, you're not disabled, you're normal. And then I talk about the people being on board with the word disabled, because in the past, a bit, you know, 10 years ago, it was a negative. I think it was a negative. And I've heard people use it even as an insult almost. I've heard someone describe Milton Keynes as disabled, which I find hilarious. And then someone said it, and then, like later that day, I looked back and I was like, I don't think that's okay. Even though it was a funny sentence. I talk about that, and I'd say, look, Dad, it's okay to be disabled. People have moved on. But he was just trying to make me feel better, not be singled out. So that's my, let's say, inverted commas, heartfelt bit. A lot, it's 90% fun and silly.
And those different sort of themes and strands you mentioned, it sounds like they sort of organically came together. It's like, okay, yes, this is what my show is going to be about. And I guess in terms of, you know, is there a point at which you have these different strands, you're pulling in different material, and then you get to a moment, it's like, okay, yeah, actually, this is now a cohesive one-hour show. It makes sense to me.
Yeah, I was doing these previews for the first time, and I'd not really done an hour on stage. So I was just throwing shit at the wall, being like, what is this? And then, you know, after the 10th preview, you're like, oh, hang on a minute, that's there. You start to see things differently, and you're like, that could be an ending. And I mentioned at the beginning, that seems quite tidy. Yeah, so I felt like it did come together. I'm happy with my show. I'm getting good reactions from the audience, and I'm just enjoying doing it.
We are past halfway now.
Yeah, yeah.
Has the show evolved even more while you've been here?
It's evolved a tiny bit. It's not really. I've tweaked bits and added bits, but the bones are the same. Yeah, same.
And beyond August, what are the plans? Oh, of course, both specifically for the show and then more generally.
I'm in a double act called The Lovely Boys, and we've just got a Radio 4 series which is coming out over this month as well, which is quite handy.
So that's already recorded?
That's done. We literally got that commission a year ago, and it's only just come out this month.
And how does that compare to your solo show?
It's very different.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So this is, I'm in a double act. We do online sketches, and they're very sort of like, it's sort of bromance, friendship, wholesome, silly, feel-good sketches. So it's like me and my best mate looking after each other, essentially, but in a weird, funny way, if that makes sense. And yeah, we've got the commission, and it's just a sketch show. We've done like various characters. We're very happy with it. It's called The Lovely Boys Talk Good. And yeah, I'm doing like listening parties. It comes out at 11 p.m. every Wednesday of The Fringe. So I'm finding like rooms. I did it at Monkey Barrel last week, listening party. It's like 14 minutes long.
Yeah.
So I'm like, everyone, I'm going to play my radio show. It's just a bit of fun. It's perfect timing coming out this month. Yeah, I'm going to do it in the Pleasance, one of the rooms there this tonight. Yeah.
And that's all presumably sitting in the radio player for the people who miss it during August while they're here.
Yes, yeah, exactly. That would go on to the BBC Sounds, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm very off-brand there.
Yeah,
it's been
called
BBC Sounds for years.
BBC Sounds.
Still calling it the radio player. So I guess beyond August, are you planning on doing more with the show that's here this year?
Yeah, I'll probably tour it a tiny bit, and then I would like to write a new show, just because I feel like
you're already planning 2025.
Yeah, I don't know if it'll be 2025, might be 2026. I just know that I would like to, because this material, I've been gigging for 8 years, I would like to park this material and start anew, fresh.
That's interesting. Almost, you see this first 1 hour as being the conclusion of that period,
yeah,
bringing together themes and material, and maybe for the next one it will be a blank sheet of paper.
I think next time it will be a blank sheet and we go again, and I've been hanging on to these bits that work, and that's, I think, a sign of fear maybe, and it's like, well, no, these bits work, hold on to them, don't do an hour, otherwise I have to burn it all. So yes, the next step will be burn it all, blank sheet. regenerate, regrow. Let's go. 2025. I don't know.
Before we burn it, let's tell people where they can see the show, this year's festival. Give us the venue, the time slot, etc.
So it's called The Attic in the Pleasance Courtyard, and it's at 6 p.m. I think I emailed the Pleasance a few months ago and said, I'd love to do a show with you about how disabled people have been marginalized and cast into the shadows for too long. And they said, yeah, you can do that in the Attic, which I was very upset with. No, I'm joking. I love the Pleasance.
That is one of the classic Pleasance venues.
Yeah, it is.
The reason I know that is the first year we did 3 weeks, 1996.
Yeah.
A very long time ago. I remember going to see a show in there, having not slept for 3 days.
Yeah.
And falling asleep.
3 days? That's too long, mate.
And I fell asleep within 2 minutes and then I woke up with the applause at the end.
Yeah.
Because back in those days, there was no air conditioning in Pleasance Courtyard.
Yeah.
You can imagine that room with no air conditioning.
It's a sweatbox. Yeah. I think, so I was talking to Andy Zaltzman, that's a bloody name drop, and he said he saw Dylan Moran debut there.
Wow.
When, you know, no one knew who he was.
Yeah.
It's quite an iconic room, yeah.
So that's the listings. Just quickly, online, where can people find you?
Online, I'm at Willie Robbins is the Insta, and then at The Lovely Boys is the double act, also on Insta.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for talking
Pleasure,
to me.
Chris.
Thank you.
We're going to shake hands. You can't see this, but we're shaking.
A formal contract to end the proceedings.